The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
Happy April Fool's Day. I have to note that it was on April Fool's Day 2000 that David Cullivan, a 22-year-old forestry student, announced the appearance of an extinct bird. Cullivan was sitting on a tree stump holding his shotgun, waiting for a turkey to appear, when he saw what he later was sure was an ivory-billed woodpecker, the Lord God bird. The ivory bill makes more than one appearance in Jonathan Rosen's profound, and I do not use the term lightly, new book, The Life of the Skies, Birding at the End of Nature. Jonathan Rosen is the author of two novels, Eve's Apple and Joy Comes in the Morning. His essays have appeared in the New York Times and the New Yorker. He is the editorial director of Next Book, and that's a wonderful series of books on Jewish thinkers and writers. There's also a wonderful website. If you haven't ever looked at it, I really recommend it. Go to www.nextbook.org. Jonathan is also the author of one of my very favorite books, The Talmud and the Internet, A Journey Between Worlds. Note the subtitle, A Journey Between Worlds, because it's quite relevant to the book we'll discuss tonight, The Life of the Skies, a work that explores the pushes and pulls, paradoxes and conundrums of the search for the wild in an age of global industrialization and damaged landscapes. As Graham Gibson writes, in the New Testament, Christ claims that not a single sparrow falls without God noticing it. We ourselves have not been nearly so attentive. Jonathan Rosen began birdwatching a decade ago. I'm sure he'll talk to us about that, and it changed the way he saw the country and the way he saw the world. In the journey represented in this book, he attempts to answer the question posed in Robert Frost's poem, What to Make of a Diminished Thing. What makes this book so profound is the way that he connects ideas, juxtaposing figures from literature and poetry with those from natural history and science, weaving together observation and choice anecdotes. We will be having a conversation tonight. I know some of you were expecting Jenny Price. Unfortunately, she had a death in the family, and she had to go back east, so she is not here tonight. I will be doing my best to be the interviewer tonight. Please turn off your cell phones and pagers, and after the program, Jonathan will be signing his book in the lobby. Books are on sale for tonight, courtesy of the library store. We will open it up to you for questions, and we'll have a microphone going around. Please wait until it comes to you because we do record for podcast. So without further ado, please welcome Jonathan Rosen to the LA Public Library. Thank you. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you.
We actually met this afternoon when we went birding on the LA River. What did you think of our LA River?
It was wonderful for urban birding.
You did get to see some things.
I did. And one of the great things about bird watching is that you get to see birds that you don't ordinarily see when you travel. So I saw a black phoebe, which is not the most exotic bird here, but since I live in New York, you don't get to see them. I always see people in Central Park looking at cardinals, and I can always tell that they live in Seattle or someplace because they're incredibly excited, whereas it's basically a yard bird.
Yeah, I was very excited to see a cardinal last time. I was like, My God, there's a real cardinal.
Exactly. And if you saw them, you know, every now and then, you'd think they were the most beautiful bird in the world.
Pretty great. Just to kind of get people oriented to what kind of the tenor of your book, why don't you read from the beginning that will kind of set the tone for the conversation and tonight's discussion?
Sure. I'll read a little bit from the prologue, but since I'm starting at the beginning, I'll start at the very beginning and I'll read the epigraph. Because I really love epigraphs. All my books have epigraphs for some reason. This one, every chapter has an epigraph. They're just kind of part of the way you, I don't know, acknowledge the conversation you're having with other books and other writers. And You're having it anyway, but this way you just kind of make it public. And the epigraph is from a wonderful D.H. Lawrence prose poem that appears in his collection of poems called Birds, Beasts, and Flowers. And at the beginning of the birds section, there's this paragraph which begins, "Birds are the life of the skies, and when they fly, they reveal the thoughts of the skies." And just when I read it years ago, I had no idea what my book was going to be about, but I knew I was going to write something about birds, and I knew I was going to call it The Life of the Skies. Just saying The Life of the Skies somehow made me happy, the way bird watching does, often does. And but I discovered that I was remembering the phrase wrong, that I kept thinking it was birds are the life of the skies, and when they sing, they reveal the thoughts of the skies. But what Lawrence wrote is so much better than that, because it isn't anything they say or articulate, much as I love birdsong. It's just the fact that they're there. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things I really want to get at in the book. It's just that sense of mere being, you know. The problem when you're a writer is you have to use a lot of words to express the wordless state that is so moving to you. But that is, Lawrence kind of captures it there. And I just say, since I'm sort of situating the book a little bit, one of the other reasons I like that phrase, the life of the skies, and the way Lawrence puts it is because it has a kind of theological overtone to it. You know, what does it mean after Darwin to say that birds are the life of the skies? What does it mean to talk about the life of the skies at all? And is it because the skies have no life of their own? You know, no transcendent life that used to be there even when Darwin was a boy? Or is there a sense in which even animal life contains something in it that's transcendent? And that's another question that I try to frame in the course of the book. First half of the book's called Backyard Birds, and the second half is called Birds of Paradise, and I'm sort of interested in how they come together. But so that's the epigraph. I promise not to do this for every sentence. You know, I did write a book called The Talmud and the Internet. It occurs to me that sometimes people ask, what's the connection? As well, more commentary than material. Anyway, I'll just read now a little bit. Everyone is a bird watcher, but there are two kinds of bird watchers, those who know what they are and those who haven't yet realized it. In the United States, a lot of people have realized it, 47.8 million Americans, according to the Fish and Wildlife Service, and yet my passion is constantly greeted with surprise. You? Perhaps it is because I live in a city and lead an urban life. But why should people wonder that I watch birds? It's like being surprised that someone has sex or goes to the bathroom. The surprise reveals ignorance not so much about birds, their beauty, their abundance, their wild allure, as about human nature. We need, as the great biologist Edward O. Wilson has argued, to affiliate with nature in order to be happy. He calls this phenomenon biophilia. The urge to watch birds is all but instinctive, dating no doubt from a time when knowing the natural world, what could be eaten and what could eat us, what would heal us and what would bring death, was essential. It's fed by our urge to know, as strong as our urge to eat. Could you imagine a lion stalking prey not out of hunger but out of curiosity? We name things. We classify them. In the Bible, Adam gives names to the natural world, imposing a human order on a chaos of life, a kind of second creation. Bird watching is as human an activity as there can be. We have one foot in the animal kingdom, where biologically we belong, but one foot in a kingdom of our own devising. As Walt Whitman said of himself, we are both in and out of the game, and watching and wondering at it. As it turns out, living in a city and watching birds is hardly a contradiction. Modern bird watching is an urban invention. Institutions of higher learning where bird skins were available, not to mention collection curators who brought their indoor learning outdoors, were virtual prerequisites as bird watching came of age. When a man is tired of London, he is tired of life, said Dr. Johnson. I live in New York City, a metropolis greater than Johnson's London, and I feel that way about my city, but I feel that way partly because it was in New York City that I discovered birds. More and more I realize that to be bored with birds is to be bored with life. I say birds rather than some generic nature, because birds are what remain to us. Yes, deer and coyote show up in the suburbs. You can see grizzlies in Yellowstone Park, and certainly there are bugs galore. But in Central Park, two blocks from my apartment, hundreds of species of birds pass through by the thousands every spring and fall, following ancient migratory routes as old as the Ice Age. If herds of buffalo or caribou moved seasonally through the park, I'd no doubt go out to see them. but the only remaining wild animals in abundance that carry on in spite of human development are birds. The rainforest is far away, but these birds, who often winter there, bring it with them. Here is the nature my biophiliac soul needs to affiliate with. In our mother's womb, we float in water, a remnant of our aquatic origins that we somehow took with us when we left the oceans that spawned us eons ago. But where are the woods, the fertile forests that also constituted the womb of our species? Birds bring us fragments, not in their beaks, but on their backs. Tiny fragments, to be sure, and not enough to reconstitute a world, but something.
Mm. Mm. That's beautiful. Thank you so much.
I was just trying to recover. Thank you.
Do you want to read some more?
No, I was just going to... I mean, I'm happy to keep reading.
Or
keep talking, as you can see. But,
well, you're talking all through the book. There's always this sense, this push-pull, these dichotomies, these two impulses. I kind of have a collection of them here, but you talk about, you say, perhaps we cannot rid ourselves of civilization any more than we can abandon our animal natures. I think that's pretty, birding for me is where the two impulses meet. Could you talk about those two impulses, how they kind of collide in the act of watching birds?
Sure. I mean, I'll say one of the things I love about bird watching is that it really is about what happens at both ends of the binoculars, too. You know, it's the wild animal you're looking at, and it's also you yourself. But
how so?
Well, it seemed initially. I think a lot of people think of nature as this thing outside of themselves. And indeed, when I discovered birds, which sounds ridiculous, but you know, I did have my little epiphanic moment where I realized there were birds migrating through the world, including the equivalent of my backyard. It was a shock, and you feel as if you're going outside of yourself, and you are, but you're also encountering an aspect of yourself. And that's the dual journey that's so interesting to me, I guess, really. And I think the part of that dichotomy you're talking about is that one of the things about bird watching is that it's, in its way, it's a bookish thing to do. You know, you go out in the woods with a book. And
it is a really funny image when you think about it.
Well, that's exactly right. But it's what I like about it is there's no pretense of abandoning the things that make us human. And you're trying to name these birds and identify them and classify them. And you're participating in this, really this 18th century process, which we are our heritage from the Enlightenment. Linnaeus was a great classifier, and you want to know the names of these birds and their characteristics, and you're drawing them into the scientific classifying world. But at the same time you're doing that, and you're putting them in the book in your pocket, they're drawing you out into their world, and you're getting led a little farther out into wildness. And for me, that captures that double pull. And I think it's also really important when you're birding, I think people do it instinctively, it's not as if you have to remind yourself to do this, to see two things when you're looking at a bird. One is you want to name it. You can't help it. You just want to know what is it. What is it? You almost want to, you know, what are you? But at the same time, you know, you want to see the wild bird for what it is, this mysterious animal that we've given a name to, but that lives in some realm beyond our names and beyond our ability to name it.
When you started birding, you went into this in a very major way. You took up classes at the American Museum of Natural History, sketching animals. You studied with some ornithologists, didn't you, as well?
Well, study would be a big word. I took an animal drawing class and was so far and away the worst person in that class. But I just wanted an excuse to be in the museum after hours, partly. I live right near the Museum of Natural History. And also I had this fantasy of, you know, sketching them in the field. And also I thought it was a way of getting more intimately acquainted with them. You know, you can't shoot them anymore, so here's a way of kind of tracing the contours of their body, I guess. But I did. I mean, I signed up for an introduction to bird watching.
At the same time, when you say you can't shoot them anymore, but you have a really interesting passage in the book about the relationship between hunting and birding, and your kind of realization that it was hunting that kind of, when you go looking for the ivory bill, that it's hunters who kind of in a sense made this wildlife area happen. Can you talk about that relationship a little bit?
Sure. That was another one of the revelations for me. You know, I feel like an idiot because I was discovering the most basic elements of human nature. That's something about my childhood, which we won't have to talk about. But when I went looking for the ivory-billed woodpecker, I was surrounded by a professor of zoology, an ornithologist, a forestry student, the guy who had seen the bird, and everyone was a hunter. And they all had this incredible relationship to the woods. Then I began to learn more about how much of the woods set aside for conservation had been set aside by hunters. When I went to Arkansas, there was a possible sighting, I mean, a very credible sighting in 2004 of the ivory-billed woodpecker. The area we were seen was all saved by a duck hunter, a dentist from Stuttgart, Arkansas, who just wanted to save the land he'd grown up hunting on.
And then you have a wonderful chapter about Theodore Roosevelt, who is known both as a great, you know, as the great hunter and also as a great conservationist. So, which is something, that's kind of shocking to us today, I think, when we really think about that.
That's right. And it took me a while to realize that he wasn't a conservationist in spite of the fact that he was a hunter. He was a conservationist because he was a hunter. And also, precisely because he was intimately acquainted with the killing urge, he knew that if he didn't sign into law these wild, you know, the protection of these wild places, that they would simply be gone. And he respected that killing urge, but he understood what it could do, especially when amplified by technology.
Now, some of the early figures you talk about, there's just an incredible collection of characters in Jonathan's book. I was just kind of making a list, and it's just a wonderful list. I mean, it goes from people who make appearance: Emily Dickinson, Wallace Stevens, Isaac Babel, Coleridge, the Baal Shem Tov, Darwin, Sufi mystics, Emerson. It's just a wonderful weaving together. But when you talk about two of the earlier figures, Audubon and is it Wallace who?
No, Wilson.
Wilson who brought who ties up the
yeah.
But they both actually, their way of capturing birds to study them was to shoot them.
Oh yeah, Audubon. It's, you know, we have Audubon societies, of course, named for him. He was a great killer of birds. His diary often just reads like a catalog of murdered birds. And in fact, they have these four great statues on top of the Museum of Natural History, and it's Lewis and Clark, Daniel Boone, and Audubon, and Audubon's leaning on a gun. But that's completely appropriate. And what's interesting, and you talk about the double impulse in birdwatching, is after he killed them, what he really wanted to do was bring them to life. And so he created this board with nails sticking out of it, and he posed them in lifelike poses. And that was really part of his great innovation as a bird artist. They used to be painted in this kind of inert, flightless, lifeless style for purposes of identification, but he really animated them. And that is the fascinating paradox, really. Of course, he didn't have binoculars, not that he would necessarily have used them. Hunting was his way of participating in the wild world that he was in and out of.
It just kind of blew my mind to think about that. I mean, just as that way of capturing to study, because you think of him as this patron saint of, you know, this gentle... But the image that really I couldn't get out of my mind was the image of Wilson and the ivory bill. Could you tell that story?
Oh, sure,
Just wild.
Alexander Wilson is really the father of ornithology in this country, and he died in 1813. He was Scottish, and he preceded Audubon in some ways, and some people think he showed Audubon, when Audubon was still a dry goods salesman, some of his bird art, and gave people imagine that perhaps Audubon got the idea, I can do this better than him, I'll paint all the birds in America. He has a wonderful and haunting description of the ivory-billed woodpecker, which, as you heard, was this big, beautiful bird, the largest.
Tell them how big it is.
It's 21 inches long, I think.
A strong bird.
Very strong, yes. Largest woodpecker in America, third largest in the world. I mean, really big. And black and white pattern with long ivory bill, like 3 inches long, which has been officially considered extinct since the 40s, I think 1944. Although it keeps getting seen and unseen. It's the Elvis of the bird world, you know. And even it looked like in 2004 it was the definitive sighting, and then it was kind of mysteriously unseen. So now it still lives in this kind of ghostly intermediate realm. There's a wonderful account of the bird that Wilson gives where he shot one, he winged it, he just wounded it, he wanted to paint it alive, and he brought it, I think it was North Carolina, he brought it to his hotel room, he went out, I think, to get it some food, and when he comes back, it's basically hammered its way almost to freedom. It's made this gigantic hole in the wall, so he ties a string to its leg, and then ties it to this mahogany table. And he leaves again, and when he comes back, the table is completely ruined, and the bird actually attacks and draws blood from Wilson. What's so wonderful, and wonderful is the wrong word, but what's so haunting about that is that he records that he makes this strange joke when he's taking the bird, this wounded bird, to the inn. He hides it under his coat, and it's screaming, and he tells the innkeeper that he'd like a room for himself and his baby. And also, when he is watching it, he's full of admiration for its ferocity, and he keeps saying, "I was tempted to let it go," which of course he doesn't do, and it refuses all food and dies after 3 days. But I mean, to talk about the paradoxical relationship to nature, I mean, here's a man who shoots a bird that he's tempted to free but doesn't, and is basically pretends a bird he's in the process of killing is his baby, and he's right about all of those things. You know, that is our complicated relationship. And it's only gotten more complicated in our age. In Wilson's age, it was less complicated because it was still a semi-pre-modern world. I mean, when you were asking about that sense of hunting, one of the things Wilson talks about, Edward O. Wilson, a great biologist and who I admire very much, we really evolved to subdue the natural world because the natural world was so vast and so bottomless. It took everything we had just to dent it a tiny bit. And so, in a sense, we are, even our antagonisms are a way of relating to the natural world. All of a sudden, we live in this modern world where, because of technology, it's not metaphorical. We literally can destroy ourselves and the natural world entirely. And so we have to prop up the very thing that we are almost genetically programmed to hunt and pursue. Mm. And that makes for, I think, psychologically very complicated, you know, because the analogy is like a weird psychological analogy I sometimes use, is that there's this great footnote in this Ernest Jones biography of Freud, where he says, he's talking about Hamlet, and he says that, you know, everyone, Ernest Jones was also a psychoanalyst, a student of Freud's, and he says everyone wants to kill his father. That's what Hamlet wanted to do. But Hamlet's problem is that somebody had actually killed his father already, and so he becomes paralyzed because his inner driving force, which should have just kept him going, is fulfilled, and he becomes paralyzed. We have this natural desire to subdue nature. We now live in a world in which nature has been so thoroughly subdued that it can only survive with our intervention.
I'm going to kind of zig and zag, but I have a question relating to that. Kind of wanted to come to at the end, but since we referred to the diminished thing, I thought it would be, there's a wonderful chapter in the book on Robert Frost, and you talk about him as writing, in a sense, the anthem, the birdwatcher's anthem, and I thought it'd be lovely if we could hear that. Do you want to read the poem?
Yeah, sure.
That's right.
I love this poem. I love this poem long before. It's called The Oven Bird. Long before I ever thought I'd see an oven bird, and it turns out you can see an oven bird every spring in Central Park. It's a relatively common warbler. There is a singer everyone has heard, loud amid summer and amid wood bird, who makes the solid tree trunks sound again. He says that leaves are old, and that for flowers, midsummer is to spring as 10 to 1, as 1 to 10. He says the early petal fall is past, when pear and cherry bloom went down in showers, on sunny days a moment overcast, and comes that other fall we name the fall. He says the highway dust is over all. The bird would cease and be as other birds, but that he knows in singing not to sing. The question that he frames in all but words is what to make of a diminished thing.
Now, what were the circumstances around the writing of this? What was...
Well, it's interesting because I always assumed that it was written in the middle of the century, late in Frost's life, because the highway dust is over all. Turns out it was written probably around 1906, 1907. When you think the first automobile olds only
what
began...
What kind of highway dust?
Exactly. Well, that's what I mean. It was only manufactured in like 1901. Already there's this sense of loss and lamentation. And I mean, he was an elegiac person in a way. He went to live on a farm. He was actually born in a city. I went to graduate school at Berkeley, and I remember being astonished to discover in San Francisco a plaque to the birth of Robert Frost. I thought he was a city boy, and he associated him with Vermont. He went to live a rural life at the very moment when most people, when suddenly the balance was tipping and more people lived in cities. So he knew already that he was seeking out a fragment of the world in order to keep himself alive as a poet, and that question, what to make of a diminished thing, reverberates in so many ways for all of us, I think. You know?
Now, when you first started birdwatching again, you said you started looking at maps in a different way. It sort of started to matter to you where things were. And that was as a result of looking at birds. So how is it that birds were connecting you to other places? And also, how were they connecting you back in time?
Well, I mean, that was part of the great discovery, really, was that you don't have to go very far to birdwatch. You can go into your backyard, or if you live in a city, the equivalent of your backyard, you can go to the Los Angeles River and see all these birds, especially during migration. And then what starts to happen is, and that's what happened to me, I went out and I saw all these migrating birds, and then you begin to think about where they come from. And a lot of the birds I see, well, they spend the winter in Central America or South America. Or at least southern part of the country, and they're on their way north of New York, or they're on their way to Canada or beyond. And so suddenly, without going very far, your mind begins to expand outward in this ever-enlarging geographical web until it's pretty much embracing the whole world. And you don't just think about the migratory journey. You think about the evolutionary journey, too, and that's also very moving. Where these birds started out. You know, their closest living relatives are dinosaurs. And then you think about your own evolutionary history. Our closest living relatives are chimpanzees. And so I think in that sense, I mean, that's like a metaphysical moment, but there's a literal sense too, because one of the things you want to do when you start seeing these birds is you want to protect them. And you think, well, Central Park looks healthy, so that's good. But of course, they winter someplace else and they summer someplace else. And so, you know, Roger Torrey Peterson said, you make a bird or you make a conservationist. That's really what he meant. And where things are matters, and birds aren't all endangered for the same reasons. And so suddenly, it just that enlarging sense of the country was also quite wonderful for me and for the whole world, too.
So it kind of brings you in close, and then it also makes you think about these other places, you know, that we're connected to, because the birds need this corridor also to move through. I was telling you just today at Echo Park, there's that little island, you know, on the other side of the Japanese little bridge in Echo Park, and it's the gate's always been closed to that little island, and it's actually a place where the mallards nest, and they opened it up for reasons we don't know why. It was lovely, kids can run on it, but as it turns out this year, there are no ducklings in the park. There's no ducklings in the lake because the nests have been plundered. So there are these, you know, great to have the freedom. And you talk a lot about that desire for freedom. You make these wonderful connections. You talked about in the Civil War, people, see if you can go through that train of thought for me again. People were fighting for a certain kind of freedom. You were juxtaposing different kinds of freedom that clash up against each other. It's kind of a theme through the book.
Right. Trying to see if I can recapture that particular thought.
Yeah, it was. It's a long train.
Right. I'm afraid I'll flub it.
Okay. Okay. You don't.
But. I guess I'd say a paradox of the Civil War is that people were fighting for states' rights. Most people fighting weren't slave owners, and so they were in a sense fighting for an ideal of a certain sort of freedom, although it actually led them to deprive others of their freedom, and that is part of the paradoxical nature of freedom itself, really, I think.
Now, in terms of how you structured this book, you're moving through, you have the narrative of looking for the ivory bill, you have your trip to Israel, so there's certain places that you chose to go to and to weave the book together, but there also, since you have these figures that anchor it, would you tell us a little bit about your research process and also just your structuring process? Did that take a long time? It seems like a very complicated interwoven structure.
Yeah, it took a while to figure out how to tell it, and because I felt I wanted to tell several stories that I hoped would all be woven together in the end and integrated. I mean, one story was my own simple awakening to the natural world through birds, but by extension, the larger natural world, what it means to live in a city and have that awakening. At the same time, I realized in that grandiose way of writers, that it, you know, the country itself has its own awakening to the natural world, and also realized how much American history is bound up with bird watching. You know, it's not a very old country, so Audubon is, as you mentioned, a main figure. Audubon arrived in America in 1803 from France, which is Thomas Jefferson was president. It was the year of the Louisiana Purchase. The country doubled in size. But by the time Audubon, you know, by the 40s, Audubon had built a house in Manhattan, and his friend Samuel Morse sent a telegraphic message to Philadelphia and just shrank the whole world in the blink of an eye. So suddenly technology took this enormous country that had doubled in size the year Audubon arrived and already began to shrink it. And then 100 years after Audubon arrived, in 1903, 100 years after Audubon's arrival, Teddy Roosevelt is president, and he's the president who presides over our entry into the 20th century, where he realized not only had the frontier closed by then, but we had turned around and started consuming our own country, and he realized that if he didn't preserve those natural places, they'd be destroyed. But I discovered that Roosevelt learned taxidermy from a guy who sailed up the Missouri with Audubon. And so, in a sense, it seems as if you've spanned the entire gamut of this transformation between the time when the country was still open and new to a time when it was shrinking and diminishing, and yet these lives were overlapping. It was just two generations, essentially, or a little more, and we live all the more outside of that. So I wanted there to be a historical narrative simultaneous to my own narrative, and then to tell the story of the Ivory Bill woven through, because the Ivory Bill touches all of those things. Alexander Wilson wrote about it. Audubon wrote about it. It takes the literal, what's literal about bird watching. You know, it's a kind of extreme form of bird watching, looking for a potentially extinct bird. You know, birds are hard to see anyway. They fly. As spring gets more progressed, the leaves get bigger, and just when there are more birds, they're harder to see. And so you really are constantly straining and looking, and to take a bird that's actually just literally flying in and out of history makes it even more poignant, more moving. And so I thought that would be a kind of binding element. Also, because there was another element that mattered to me, and I talked about that when I talked about the epigraph to the book, what it means to speak of the life of the skies. And the quest for the Ivory Bill has taken on a kind of interesting religious overtone of its own, you know, and it answers this, doesn't answer this question, but it furthers this question. What do we look for when we look at the natural world? Everyone calls it the Lord God bird now. I don't know if people are familiar with that term. People say it was one of its common names. When you saw it, you said, Lord God, what a bird, because it was so big. But James T. Tanner, who really wrote the book on the Ivory Bill, has this long list of common names, and none of them is the Lord God bird. It's clearly, I mean, it appears in a Faulkner story, but it clearly answers some need people have for repair, for wholeness, and maybe even for something else, what it means to recapture something. And so I wanted to, for me, weaving that through, try to accomplish, I guess, the things that interest me. You want the literal and the metaphorical simultaneously held together in birding, the way you want those two things held together.
And you do a wonderful job of that. I think you also, the figures that you do talk about, I mean, for me, it was like a really fruitful way to read about Thoreau and a fruitful way to read about Whitman in this context, because it made certain things about them really, you know, gave them great, just gave a depth to that discussion. I really enjoyed that. The conversation that what you wrote about Thoreau and the things, could you talk a bit about the idea of a lie? What you noticed that Thoreau left out, and why that bothered you about Walden? Because then it leads into Audubon's lie as well.
Sure. I mean, I love Thoreau. I think Walden's a great book, obviously. But I have a kind of quarrel with Thoreau also, I suppose. And actually, it touches. We were talking a little earlier today about nature writing and whether I like it or not. And
I wanted to, like, when we first got to the LA River, sort of like, I wanted to, like, should I apologize? It's like, I'm bringing a guest here, you know, but this is what is.
Apologize for the river. Oh, that's so touching.
No, not apologize for the river, but I mean, it's sort of like, you know, you thought I might be bringing you to this, you know, this wilderness place and, you know, the river, but this is what our migratory birds have, and this is why it's so important to us to restore it. So it's those things that you want that get left out of the picture we were talking about. talking about.
Yeah, no, trust me, Central Park is a multi-use facility, as they say.
You're tripping over condoms while you're
absolutely,
bird-watching, right?
Absolutely. And you know, with your binoculars, there are things you don't even want to see with the naked eye. What was the question?
Nature writing, what Thoreau left out? The pies. The pies is mother.
Right, well, I mean, Thoreau, on the one hand, I think it's a paradox, because I think he, on the one hand, did this great thing, which is he could have gone way out into the wilderness, the frontier was still open, but he went basically into his own backyard or somebody else's. He borrowed land from Emerson, and he's just 500 yards from the railroad tracks, and you can hear a train go by. But he doesn't, he is seeking something. What I think he does is he does something unnatural, and he makes it seem like the ultimate natural thing to do. He goes off alone, no family, and he makes that seem like the paradigm of being in nature. Mm. I also resent a little bit that he writes with a certain contempt for the human beings he sees. They get in the way of the picture. And he writes about these laborers trudging home with their families. And the truth is, those laborers have more in common with the birds he's so into, because birds spend most of their time, you know, looking for food and procreating. And so I think that's had a bad influence on nature writing, actually, too, that you just put a copy of Walden in your backpack and you go off alone, and you exclude all the human elements. You exclude what's on the near side of the binoculars, let's say. Also, he would go home for dinner. I mean, I don't hold it against him. It makes perfect sense to me. His sister would leave jelly donuts outside the door, and I think that that's all, you know, a natural whole part. I wish he had written about it, because I think that it he was kind of creating nature as a new paradigm. It was almost taking the place of religion for him. And
you know, as you were saying that, I was realizing that's kind of what the film, I don't know if you've seen Into the Wild yet, Sean Penn actually made a very beautiful film of the John Krakauer book, but this young man who feels like he must go off into the wilderness with his Walden, you know, with his Thoreau, you know, and finally learns that, you know, it's you know, happiness is there when it can be shared. You know, it was a very hard lesson, and he lost his life over that. But I think that was kind of the area that you were talking about.
Yeah, and I think we lie to ourselves a little bit. I met a nature photographer, a filmmaker, who said that when he goes to Africa to make these films, there's no problem finding a wild lion. The problem is finding a wild lion without tourists in the back. And he needs to cut them out because he's gratifying the expectations of his audience. But it would do us good to know that this is what it means to see a lion today in Africa. That's part of world these animals live in.
Right.
And also we are part of we're part of the story in a sense.
I won't make you recount all the stories in the book. There's so many great stories, but just tell us about because it's quite a fantastic story to come across, and then it's a fantastic story to come across that it's not the story that we thought it was about Audubon and his monkey.
Yeah, sure. This actually speaks to what you were asking before also, I think, about the tension between the hunting urge and the civilizing urge. So Audubon tells a story at the very beginning of his memoir, which he calls Myself, that his mother had some pet monkeys and some pet parrots. And one morning, the parrot, his favorite parrot, asks for breakfast in French, because he's living
really
in Haiti. And the monkey, for some reason, becomes enraged and insulted and stands up, walks over to the parrot, and kills it. And it's a great story, because Audubon says, he's basically addressing his memoir to his children. He says he thinks about it every day. He's thought of it thousands of times, and he imagines that it's the source of his enduring love of birds. He was a little boy, and he witnessed, this is this primal scene, the murder of the parrot. I'm fascinated by the story, however much it turns out maybe to have been stretched in various ways, simply because he refers to the monkey as the man of the woods. And his sympathies are all with the parrot, even though we talked about what a bird killer he was. But actually, he knew he was also the man of the woods. I mean, and that's the paradox that I think you encounter all the time when you're bird watching or when you're thinking about nature. Anyway, these two animals have the two signal aspects of human identity: speech, the talking parrot, and the killer primate. And we're kind of both those things. And Audubon understood that about himself too, which is why, you know, he was both a killer of birds and an animator of birds. But you want me to tell you about how he lied, right? So I discovered that he had made that story up in all sorts of ways. In the course of telling this, he talks about how his mother was a high-born, rich Louisiana woman, lady, who his father, who was French, married when Louisiana was still owned by the French, and brought her back, and brought her to what was to become Haiti after the slave revolt. And that's where the story takes place. But actually, it turns out that's not true at all. And in fact, having said that and then told the story, you feel he's really offering up to his readers a kind of racial parable that he knew they'd get. That his he says his mother was killed in the slave revolt, and then they his father fled with him. And so here's this, and then he tells a story about this monkey who kills the mother's favorite parrot. Turns out his mother was a chambermaid, not married to his father, one of his father's many mistresses, and she died just a few months after Audubon was born. So in a way, he made up the whole thing. First of all, the story, I believe that he thought of the story in some form every day. What interests me partly about the, I love the story, but I love the lie too in a way, because Audubon was obsessed with being illegitimate. He knew he was a bastard. He was constantly hiding it. He was afraid he'd be disinherited as a result. And he was afraid, ashamed of his origins. And so he fabricates this complicated story about his origins. But in a sense, which of course, not of course, but tellingly, I think, has therefore a racial component to it. After Darwin, you know, when we've all, it's made monkeys of us all in a way, that story has an added reverberation for me, because shame about origins is so bound up, I think, with human nature anyway. And our origins, what are our origins? And can we accept them? And what do we find about them? I think racism of a certain sort got worse after Darwin for all sorts of reasons, but one of them is it was a way of displacing the intolerable information about ourselves onto particular groups of people. You know, Jews were often presented as ape-like, and so it just became and so the whole story becomes complicated in a way that I think we're still grappling with, partly because I think we're still trying to figure out the meaning of the of that theory, which is of evolution, the 150th anniversary of which is actually coming up, technically this summer when the papers were read at the Linnean Society.
But I love all through this book that you don't shy away from these complexities, you know, that you kind of push deeper into the stories so that they yield, you know, all these interesting ramifications. It's really fascinating. I just really loved it. I'm going to open it up just in a few minutes to questions. I just have two other questions. One, you have so many these beautiful chapters where you go to Israel looking for birds. I thought maybe you could talk a little bit about, in a sense, why Israel, in a sense, is so emblematic of some of the paradoxes inherent in bird watching.
Sure. Well, for one thing, I didn't really know it was a good place for birds. That was part of, in the same way, I didn't know Central Park was a good place for birds. Israel's a particularly good place for birds because it gets a migration from Europe, from Asia, and from Africa, and they're all forced to funnel over this little tiny land bridge. They can't fly over the desert, they don't fly over the sea, and so that's what makes for a wonderful migration. I was told it's second only to Panama in the variety of its migration, which is remarkable for such a tiny country. It's also very moving, of course, to be in a place where borders are everything, and yet for the birds, there aren't.
Right.
And this very idealistic, wonderful bird watcher in Israel, Yossi Leshem, who took me around, has this birding center he created in Latrun, where that's the motto, migrating birds know no boundaries. And of course, it's not, you know, it has a kind of poignancy now, especially because he saw it as a way of building harmony, which hasn't happened at all. But also, you know, it's partly I had my personal relationship to Israel. I had my political relationship. I had a religious relationship. I didn't have any relationship to the avifauna of it, to the natural history of the place. And in the same way that I am in some weird way a cultural descendant of that place, the very place where the story of Eden was created, I'm also a you know, I have my natural history as well, just as that place did, and so it's bringing those two things together that Israel kind of typifies. This is wonderful. In his memoir, I think it's his autobiography, Edward O. Wilson, the biologist I keep talking about, who's still alive, talks about being near the ruins of Solomon's temple, as he says, but then he gets on his hands and knees. He's an entomologist, and he starts looking at these ants, and he really becomes obsessed with the million-year history of the ants. Mm, mm. And for him, the two are equally important. And I think that that's part of the interest,
yes,
of the thing. And I tell a story. There may not be time to tell it about Henry Baker Tristram, who was this great 19th-century figure, who was an early Darwin, the first person to cite the origin of the species in print. His name was Henry Baker Tristram. He was an Anglican priest. But then he panicked about Darwin, and he was present at one of these famous debates that they had where the supporters of Darwin would face off against the representatives of the church, and there was a very famous one where Bishop Wilberforce was speaking for the Anglican church, and Darwin was kind of a fraidy cat, and he was sick a lot, and he stayed home, but his supporters came, and they had a debate, and the supporter who spoke most famously was Thomas Huxley, who was known as Darwin's bulldog, and Bishop Wilberforce sneeringly said to Huxley, "Are you descended from an ape on your grandmother's side or your grandfather's side?" And Huxley said, "I'd rather be descended from an ape than a clergyman." And but it was a huge happening. There were like 1,000 people there. Women were fainting. It was very hot. This guy, Henry Baker Tristram, this wonderful naturalist who was also an Anglican priest, was there, and he turned to his friend. He said, I'm not a Darwinian anymore. He was put off. But what had already happened to the nature of the debate was that it had already become debased. It was an either-or on both sides. But what's interesting about Tristram is he really couldn't run away entirely from his understanding of origin of the species by means of natural selection, because he already understood it. So he sort of ran away, and he kept going to Palestine, and he wrote these books that were hugely successful, Natural History of the Bible, which he'd hunt down every bird species, and did the quail, how did the quail blow across for the Israelites? And he kind of winds up discovering that the processes of the mean God works according to the methods of nature. And by the end of his life, he had come back around to Darwin. He refers to Darwin as our great teacher, but he kind of had to do it in a roundabout way. And the fact that he did it in Palestine, in this place that is the origin of the story of Eden, that he had to make his peace in his own way with both those things. Mm-hmm. And he was kind of giving himself therapy over the course of these many years. He did not want to lose either aspect, the natural history of the place or the Bible itself. Mm-hmm. And so he kind of is an intermediate figure. For me, bird watching makes everyone a 19th century naturalist again. I love it that there was this time when natural inquiry was theological inquiry, and all these things were bound up together, and it was all done by amateurs.
You ask a really important question. Well, it goes all through the book, and as you say, I have written down here, you said, you're talking about this desire to, you say, can repair have its own romance in terms of not undoing the damage, but how we're going to kind of deal with the damage that we've done. We didn't read the passage about the kind of death of the end of the passenger pigeons, which is, you know, this kind of mass slaughter that went on. But this idea of repair having its own romance, I think, is something we have to think about so seriously right now. And it made me think about William James's, you know, the moral equivalent of war. And if this idea of, if through our love for keeping these birds, you know, keeping this life alive, can inspire people with the same kind of urgency, can there be, in a sense, a moral equivalent to war that could come out of something, out of our love for nature? I mean, do you believe that it can?
I do believe that it can. I think it is a great and fascinating, it is our challenge. I mean, that's just absolutely our challenge. It's interesting to use a strange analogy that sort of occurs to me while you're talking. I worked at this Jewish newspaper called The Forward, which was this great immigrant newspaper. It was a Yiddish paper. It's 100 years old. And the great story there, and the story that was inherited by all the writers, the Jewish American writers who became iconic, like Saul Bellow, was the journey out, the journey away. Ellis Island was like Mount Sinai. It was the epicenter. And the farther away you moved from ethnicity into America itself, the grander the story. And can the journey back have the same kind of romance? Mm. Does reclamation, does recovery, does repair, does return also excite the imagination? I think it does. But I think we shouldn't be sentimental about knowing about what we've lost as well.
Would you conclude our conversation by reading a little bit of the epilogue, and then we'll open up for questions?
Sure. Maybe I'll just read the epigraph to the
epilogue. The epigraph with commentary.
I'll give you the epigraph with commentary, yeah. And you'll tell me if there's time to read anything afterwards. I'd love to be able to read a little more, but I do. It's a strange epigraph, but it's important to me. It's a really haunting line I came upon in a biography of Emerson. There's a wonderful biography called The Mind on Fire by a guy named Robert Richardson. And this is Emerson, basically. What was the name of my best friend? That's the statement. What was the name of my best friend? It's Emerson suffering from dementia, asking about Thoreau. And I mean, one of the things I find so haunting about that, of course, is, you know, here's this biography, The Mind on Fire. Emerson knew the name of every plant on his property. He had this vivid, vivid mind, and Thoreau and Emerson are quite important to this book in certain ways. And the fact that he would lose them is deeply haunting. And bird watching for me is very much bound up with memory. I mean, you have to remember what the birds look like. You have to remember what they sound like. I actually have a very bad memory. I'm like an Oliver Sacks character. You know, every time, every spring, I'm starting as if I'm in the
continuous present. Well, I know your sense of direction is challenged.
Exactly. I got lost in your house.
It's not a big house.
Right. But you make lists. All the things that you do with birdwatching is almost to hold on to what's going to disappear. The birds are moving because they fly, and they're moving because the seasons are changing, and one out of four birds is threatened in some way, according to the Audubon Society. And so they're leaving us in all sorts of ways, and you make these lists, and you're kind of interposing them between yourself and that sense of loss. And you really see birds as against, almost like stars against a black sky, against the sense of that. And also, when I went to look for the ivory-billed woodpecker, that very first time, my father had been diagnosed with dementia, and so he was really losing his memory. And I used to visit him at this nursing home near Central Park on 106th Street. 106th is the original northern border of Central Park. It was pushed to 110th, but it's kind of wild up there. And I would always bring my binoculars with me because just there was that sense of wanting to fill my head with all these new names and all these words.
Would you read
things.
That passage?
Yeah,
it's so
sure.
Beautiful.
I don't know where it is.
It's right near the end. Find it.
Help me. I will find it. While I'm looking, I'll say that in a sense that the question you asked me about the romance of recovery, it's part of that, because even looking for the ivory-billed woodpecker took on that desire to recover something. As I mean, extinction itself is a kind of cosmic memory loss, really, you know, as if the earth could just forget.
Here it is, birding and memory go together.
Yeah, where is that?
In the what galley, page it's 282.
Well, I got the galley too, so okay. That's good for me. Birding and memory go together in a very basic way. In a very basic way, I wanted to keep my mind alive to stave off my father's fate, forcing into my head black-throated blue and black-throated green, common yellow throat and yellow-breasted chat, the white tail band of a magnolia warbler seen from below, the chestnut undertail coverts of a catbird. I was greedy for birdsong, the buzzy rising scale of a parula warbler, the wooden whistle of an oriole, the harsh cry of a red-tailed hawk. D.H. Lawrence ends the prose poem that begins "Birds are the life of the skies" with the phrase, "All birds have their voices, each means a different thing." To me, each song meant the same thing, a sort of liquid memory poured into my mind. I'll stop there because it starts talking about canary brain cells, and maybe that's less maybe that's less poetic. But Audubon, at the end of his life, also developed dementia. Mm. They think maybe because of the arsenic that he used to preserve his specimens. And there's something also about thinking about Audubon with all those bird names flying out of his head at the end of his life. Many of them he'd made up, you know. But you were asking me this morning about the Audubon banded the first bird ever. You know, he tied when he was a very young man. He has this beautiful passage where there was a cave on his property as a young man. When he was just starting to draw birds, he abandoned it, but he would bring the woman he was going to marry there, and there were these Phoebes outside the cave, and he tied a silver thread around the foot of one of those birds, and the nestlings, and they all came back, and that was really the first instance of bird banding. But what's so moving for me is that he was just as he was falling in love, you know, he was with this woman, he was also kind of marrying the natural world, and the world was really all before him then. And so, you know, you have this image of Audubon at the end of his life losing his memory, as everyone will. We are, you know, we have to deal with our own personal losses, but then you think of him as in 1803, really, with the whole country before him. And that, for me, in its essence, is what birdwatching is about. It's just about the desire for more life, really, I think.
That's really lovely. Let's open it up to you. I'm sure you have some questions, and Justin's got the microphone. We were going to ask if there are any ornithologists in the room, and if so, we were going to ask them to please step out.
Exactly. Please leave. But if there was a hard question, I was going to say, is there an ornithologist in the room?
I think there might be.
Are you an ornithologist? Oh. Well, that's okay. You can still ask
there.
A question. Sure. Yeah.
Hi. I was just curious. Are you familiar with any bird that has been considered extinct and made a grand reappearance unknown to everyone? And just all of a sudden reappeared?
I do not, except that the ivory-billed woodpecker comes as close to that because it really was officially considered extinct, and then people began seeing it, and then it may or may not yet have returned. There are birds that were disappeared almost, you know, the peregrine falcon really was gone from the wild and then was brought back by falconers. Talk about the role of hunters in conservation. It was because falconers knew what it meant to kind of capture a bird, borrow it, and then let it go again, that they were able to perform this grand act of conservation. But
there was a question there. Did you have a question, ma'am?
Maybe she has the answer.
I have never birdwatched, but I was in Ecuador, and was a place where a lot of birdwatchers were, and it seemed to me to be kind of a competitive sport. Do you find it that way?
Well, there can be a very competitive aspect to what's more traditionally subset. The subset is birder. The birders, the British call them twitchers, which is appropriately demeaning, you know, in a way, as if you just can't contain yourself. I do think that it's bound up with that, with an aspect of the hunting urge, that there is this desire, the kind of rapacity. You just want to have it. You want to see it. You want to get it. And there are a lot of people who do it competitively. But I think the term I'm trying to rehabilitate, in a way, is bird watching. And when Fish and Wildlife says 47.8 million Americans are bird watchers, they're not all like those diehard listers who are going out there and making you feel bad. And also, because the thing about bird watching is you want to see the bird and get its name, but then you also just really want to watch it, because it'll. But yes, I'd be. That's a long answer. The short answer is yes. There are some really competitive bird watchers out there, birders out there.
At the same time, I went on the Christmas bird count and just at Echo Park Lake. It was the first time I ever went on one this year, and I found, you know, being a kind of more of a novice bird watcher, that people were so helpful. I mean, they were, you know, so willing to kind of, they were so happy that someone was, that they could kind of bring someone in, that I felt like there was this great generosity.
I couldn't agree with you more. And that's really how I learned. And I took, every now and then there's an unusual bird in Central Park. There was a Western Tanager, not unusual for you all out here, but it's a beautiful bird. And I took my 8-year-old daughter to go find it, because it was at this place, Tanner Spring, that I really love in Central Park. And she said, "How do we find it?" And I said, "Look for someone with binoculars." and indeed, there were these four women, and they said, "Oh, yeah, it's right over there."
Well, that's very funny. That's kind of analogous to, I don't know why, but it's kind of like getting it backwards, looking for the people to find the bird. It's kind of like your story of Levi Strauss walking and trying to go back into primitive civilization, and he couldn't get a Chopin tune out of his head.
Yeah, that's right. And he was very annoyed about it, really, because he wanted his fantasy.
An earworm, yeah.
I wanted to ask, what was your first birding experience that got you, that made you into a bird watcher?
Well, it was really almost instantaneous. That's the strange thing. I mean, I was at lunch, you heard. I think it says 10 years in the galley, but it's 15 years ago, really. Almost, not to the week, but when this guy said, "Oh, the warblers will be coming through Central Park soon." And that almost, I mean, it's embarrassing to admit, but that almost did it itself. But then I took these two classes. I mean, it was just two classes.
It wasn't just some guy.
No, he was a rabbi.
He was a rabbi.
But I don't think that added to his ornithological authority. It did add to the strangeness of the blending of elements. If who would have thought that it would be a rabbi to point? I mean, I'm happy, but it wasn't. Didn't happen to me when I was young. But that's also in the interest of not being a Thoreauvian liar, right?
Right, right.
It's not the generic desired lunch at which a person said warblers. Was this little Jewish guy who said, hey, they're the amazing birds. But then anyway, I took the class, and the class was just a bunch of slides. And she would show us these slides and then say, write down what you remember. And I was amazed at how many things I didn't remember. What color was it? Was that, where was the yellow? On the bottom of the tail, on the top? And that alone was intriguing, you know, because you want, especially as a writer, but I think anybody, you want to think of yourself as observant. And then we went on a field trip, and the field trip was the most basic field trip. One was to Jamaica Bay Wildlife Preserve, which is in Queens, not far from JFK Airport. And, you know, you can see the city in the background. In those days, you could see the World Trade Center. And there were all these birds I'd never seen before, and I was just totally captivated. And then Central Park is what really did it for me. I was embarrassed in Central Park because it conjured up feelings that I knew were very different from how I must have looked. I just looked like a guy with binoculars walking through the park. But there were already birds, spring migrants coming through. It was a yellow warbler, a canary yellow bird with little rusty streaks. And I could actually see it. And the fact that it had been there my whole life without my knowing it. And I kept thinking, actually, because it was so unlike me, this will go away. And then I remember I went the first time not on a walk, and I had that same feeling of as if I were in some exotic, faraway place. And I kept waiting for it to go away, and it never went away. And that's because it isn't just a hobby, really. It doesn't have to be about bird watching. It was really just my encounter with the natural world in almost token form, but real enough to sustain that need I had to feel whole, which is the other thing you really just want.
And the strangeness, if you don't do it very often, of looking up.
Yes, exactly.
You write about it so well. You know, it really is like look up. We don't really do that very often. You know, we ignore the skies very much. The question over here.
Oh, okay. That's...
I was wondering if in the research for your book, you came across any connection between the huge increase in the number of people watching birds and the increase in conservation efforts. I don't know how better to put that. Because I know the people that I know who have begun watching birds, you can't help it. You start wanting, like you were saying, you start wanting to save places. And I just wondered if in your research you'd come up against any statistics.
I haven't come up with it. It would be a very good statistic to come up with. First of all, because it confirms that general sense that the way you get people to become conservationists is by getting them to fall in love with the thing they should save and not simply telling them in a dire way. Because you do need a reason to save things. And what those reasons are is also very interesting for me, you know. You know, if you can destroy the world, you have to ask yourself, why not, you know? And is there a religious... What are the imperatives? What do we owe the natural world? And why? Why does it matter if one species goes extinct? What is our moral obligation to it? But I do think... I mean, I'd like to think so. What I wish bird watchers would do a little bit is do something that hunters do, which is they organize them... Because they all have to buy permits or fisher... You know, men have to buy... If you go fishing, you have to buy a permit. That gives you a lot of clout with the government. You know, there may be 47.8 million bird watchers, but if there's no, even if there's a tax on bird seed, I can't think of a single bird watcher I know who would particularly want to buy a birding license. It's the ultimate independent activity. But on the other hand, you know, you buy, it's the duck stamps that saved, that was able to lobby for and actually purchase that land. And so I kind of do, I wouldn't mind seeing some of that organization, because that I think actually is what can bring change too. Yeah, this. Oh, I'm sorry. I don't want to make you run around.
Sorry. He's got to lose some weight.
I was just wondering if you were around when there was all the excitement about pale mail in New York, and if a lot of people became interested in birding when there was all this news and everything about pale mail.
I was around, it's funny. I'd like to think so. And I loved it that there were hawks there, and you see them all the time over the park. First, you see the pigeons panicking. You know, even in the street when I just walk, I take my daughter to school. She knows now when the pigeons start flying back and forth. You look even higher up, and you see a hawk usually overhead. I don't know how much it transferred. I hope so. I think so. But I think also it was seen almost as a Central Park love story, and there's nothing wrong with that at all, of course. But the thing about hawks is that they you know rip the bellies of squirrels open, and they don't really fall in love. And so you kind of hope that everyone just encounters the natural world and all its realness.
And they were kind of anthropomorphizing it like a movie magazine kind of romance?
Yeah, a little bit. But it's interesting because, you know, we talked about the passenger pigeon, which Audubon has these harrowing descriptions of. You know, they took
it's
3 days
harrowing.
For the flocks to pass, and the branches broke under the weight of their bodies. But when he painted them, he painted these two birds. They look like they're lovers, really. They're very tender and delicate. They were birds that needed huge flocks in order to breed, and they were, scarily massive. Like 40% of the bird population was all passenger pigeon. But when he paints them, he individuates them, and that's just a kind of classic impulse in a way. Mm.
Back there in the blue shirt.
I was wondering if you could say any more about some of the connotations or sort of cultural associations of bird watching or birding. I'm thinking particularly about still the oddity of a very Jewish writer and Jewish person writing about this. When I started bird watching as a kid, you know, my family's Jewish, I'm Jewish. My dad and I were the only Jews in the area, who would go to this local Audubon club, and the big event was the Christmas bird count, and everyone was very, very, very nice, and we were so clearly in a different cultural milieu. And then, you know, I grew up to be an adult gay man, and birding is not, you know, the most popular gay pastime. So I was just wondering if, you know, who you find birds or doesn't, or what associations it still has.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, as you heard, it was a rabbi who said the warblers are coming through. Definitely, I did not grow up in a family where my father got excited about spring migration. My father was born in Vienna. It was not, and you know, Woody Allen has his famous comment, "I am at two with nature," and I think that that's basically probably summed up the family ethos. So more for my father than for my mother. You know, on the other hand, it all depends how far back you go. King Solomon is like the Dr. Doolittle of Judaism. He talked to the animals, and it's interesting. I mentioned being at the Foreword. I was Abraham Kahn, who was the great founder of the Yiddish Foreworts in 1897, and it was this socialist Yiddish newspaper. It turns out he was a bird watcher, and the reason I discovered it is because in 1903, the year of the Kishinev pogrom, which was this very terrible pogrom, Kahn was bird watching in Connecticut, and he apparently heard the news and rushed back to New York because he wanted to. With his bird guide and his binoculars, he wanted to be with other birders, which tells you there weren't a lot of birders in Connecticut. But
wanted to be with other birders?
I mean, other Jews. He wanted to be with other Jews, exactly. Get me out of Connecticut. I'm going back to the Lower East Side where all the bird watchers are. But on the other hand, his impulse makes perfect sense to me, you know, because he was exploring the world around him. And I think that I always thought that was like an old world lingering discomfort I myself had inherited, but that it's perfectly natural now that bird watch, all those cultural associations that I have with birds, were bound up with things I'd already been thinking about. You know, what is my place in the natural world? What to make of a diminished thing? My goodness, you can't be a Jew in the 20th century without asking that question. It may be a cultural question, but it's also an environmental question. But when I was down writing about the ivory-billed woodpecker, I noticed I kept writing IB woodpecker in my notebook, which is, and you know, IB sing. I kept the, and they're connected really because they're both remnants, and you know, it's the last. How do you find wholeness out of brokenness? And but I also think that re-encountering the natural world is essential for all religions in a way. You know, Zionism itself was in a way an extension of a desire to return to a sense of land that had been lost, to disband a sense of disembodiment that had been you know lasted for 2,000 years. And so, in some strange way, I think it's connected. But there are tons of Jewish bird watchers at this point. You know.
How about one last question back there?
I think it was last year or the year before. There was a great story for about a week where I think it was a white Arctic bird got lost and ended up in the Salton Sea. And I was just struck by the anecdotal stories of people who would just literally stop everything and drive hundreds of miles to make sure they got there to see that. And I was just wondering if in your experience in the last 10 years, if you have anything to share about something that you heard, something was spotted and you dropped your breakfast and just jumped in the car and drove as fast as you could, like?
No, but I think it's a wonderful notion, really, because this particular bird is in this particular place, and, you know, I didn't drop everything, but I did take the subway down to Union Square Park, which is a, you know, busy downtown area of Manhattan, to see a Scots Oriole, which is actually a bird that belongs around here.
Did someone tell you it was there? I mean,
I got an email.
You got an email.
I mean, that's the thing too. It takes the romance a little bit out of it. You always want to be the person to stumble on it, not to be the guy who gets the email. But no, there was an email by every birder in New York knew about it, and people were driving in apparently people drove several hours to see it. It had never been seen in New York State before. It's a beautiful oriole. It lives in Texas and southern part of California, and it just got lost. And there was something very moving about seeing this vagrant, this bird that had blown off course, but there it was. And so, yes, but I'm not a collector of birds in that way. I think we really want to just travel to see them.
Well, you certainly are a collector of wonderful stories, and it's such a rich experience reading your book. I want to thank you so much. And Jonathan will be out in the lobby with his book, so please join us, and please join me in thanking Jonathan Rosen for...
Thank you very much.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.